Welcome to the Maine Reader on Maine Airs, the Maine Audio Information and Reading Service, a program of the IRIS Network, serving Maine's blind and visually impaired. My name is Cynthia Bowman, and I'm reading The Log of the Skipper's Wife. This is the diary of Dorothea Moulton Bellano, edited by her son, James W. Bellano. Life on board ship continues with laundry and ironing, no more pleasant tasks than they are on land. News of the rest of the world is sprinkled in with the domesticity. For example, in 1911 Dorothea predicts the Kaiser will precipitate a war with England. Also, New Mexico became a state. The heat frays tempers, but evening rides in the launch usually cool things down. Interestingly, 5 of 7 schooners in port in Jacksonville, Florida, are Maine ships. Wonder what we'll learn in our next episode. Thursday, September 14th, 1911. Headwinds out of the northwest all night, passed several steamers, or they passed us, and now a 3-master is following us astern. Nearly finished a sofa pillow. To have a new hat in Boston or not to have, that is the question. Tacked at 4 bells in the afternoon, got a sounding of 47 fathoms. Lard on the lead showed sandy bottom. In closer than we thought, toward land, so tacked offshore on a northeast course, but made little seaway in the calm. Friday, September 15th, somewhere north of Nantucket Lightship, but south of Cape Cod. Had thought of writing Betty a note, but if I did, would say that for her own sake I was thankful she was not here, and she might misinterpret that. Her feelings might be hurt. The best way out is to write nothing but get done with soldiering and wash the overhead of the mess room, which I prefer to call the dining room. Said task is only half done, and it is evening. Do not feel very well. The world sometimes goes around before my eyes. Cape Cod light is flashing off on the port bow, and we have a good breeze. Shall it be Beverly tomorrow? Saturday, September 16th, 1911. Heading in the wrong direction, running for Nova Scotia as fast as this wind will take us. Too cloudy, dark, and foggy to haul up for tricky Boston Bay. Then, near noon, with the wind decreasing, we hauled in a bit more westerly, then southwest, and finally heard Cape Cod's foghorn, a blast lasting 8 seconds. Very foggy. The mate said, "It's clear overhead, Captain." The captain said, "We ain't going that way, not just yet." With all the running abouts, handling sails, I marveled at one crew member, a little squat San Blas Indian Fred picked up off Panama. While the West India blacks and the Matthews County boys from Virginia would climb up and down the ratlines to shift the gaskets and lines for the topsails, little Jackson calmly walked from mast to mast on the stays, 90 feet above the deck, his broad, bare feet manipulating the narrow stays as though they were padding along a forest trail. Very calm now and thick of fog. Soundings gave us 55 fathoms at 1 p.m. The bottom is rocky and broken, like me. Am too discouraged and so permeated with this deadening pea-soup fog that I can't do anything. Even letters are a bore. Sunday, September 17th, 1911. Somewhere off Cape Cod. Somewhere. 13 days out of Jacksonville today. One of the slowest passages my boy ever made, and is he sick about it. Laid to all last night and rolled, but it was good to have my poor tired boy get a good night's sleep for a change. At dawn the fog lifted a bit and showed us Cape Cod Lighthouse on Race Point, just where it should have been all the time. 3 steamers sighted. Sailed up the bay and sighted Nantasket shore at 4 in the afternoon. A good steady breeze, but dusky. Can't find that shirt ribbon, the white one, to make a bow for my hat. The foggy fates have conspired to make me get a new one. Or was it a sacrifice they took to clear the fog away? Am I going batty, too? Monday, September 18th, Boston, would you believe it? Anchored off Baker's Island last night, sailed in early this a.m., hired a launch to set me ashore from the stream and spent all day in Boston. Returned on board by launch in the early evening, just as the tug was docking the Hopkins. Shopped furiously all along Washington Street and up at Houghton's. We're going to Maine, so must get busy on my new suit. Shall never forget the last time in Thomaston when the ladies gave me the party. I asked Fred what to wear. He said, call the hostess, Cousin Thankful, and ask. I did. She said, oh, just something, anything. I was suspicious, but helpless until Central, the telephone operator, who waited for Thankful to hang up, said, Cousin Dorothea, I want you to know, so's you won't feel odd, that every one of those girls are going to be all dressed up in their best bib and tucker. Wednesday, September 20th, 1911. 30 years old today. My villainous but darling boy gave me a present of $25. Wasn't that lovely, after I had spent so much money in Boston? Took the steamer to Belfast and back down to Rockland. Up early to cross the Rockland Wharf and catch the little white steamer Monhegan, one of Captain Archibald's, for Port Clyde. Sailed out around impressive, high Owl's Head, and down the Mussel Ridge Channel past the picturesque fish weirs off Ash Point. Saw 7 schooners waiting for paving block cargoes in Long Cove. Tennant's Harbor was loaded with 2 masters. Then on around Mosquito Island we raced, and off Marshall's Point, where suddenly opened up the charming village of Port Clyde. How dreadful to call it Herring Gut! No wonder Mother B. was instrumental in having it named Port Clyde. She also got Horse Point Road changed to Pleasant Street, she says, but apparently that change did not stick. Cousin Alice Bellano Davidson dropped in on us from Tennant's Harbor, and it was good to see her. She was so kind to us at her home in Melrose, where we were married. Her father, Captain John Bellano, was lost at sea. Fred says he never wanted to go deep water, but had set his course for being a barge skipper on the Gowanus Canal in Brooklyn, where he could have a daily paper and fresh milk. From the big house at Port Clyde, we took Captain J.W.'s big regal car, and Fred tacked along the dirt road to Martinsville, past Aunt Froney's house, to visit Captain Joel Hupper and his lovely wife, Aunt Mary, Roscoe's mother. Fred gave her a bottle of Madeira wine, but, much to his dismay, she said they had no use for such any more. The Regal had only 1 flat tire during the ride, which Fred says is something of a record. The autumn foliage, reds, yellows, and siennas, all took the curse off Fred's curses at the tire. A boy stopped his trudging along the road to help Fred, and we gave him a ride, his first in an automobile, he said, to Tennant's Harbor. Fred and he talked of preferring horses. Said Fred, up where you come from, there's no autos yet, is there? Later I asked Fred how he knew that the boy was from up country. Red cap and hunting boots, said Fred. Real swamp maniac, our coastal boys wear rubber sea boots, even playing ball, and sometimes go to bed in them. Thursday, September 21st, 1911, at Port Clyde, nay, Herring Gut. Beautiful sunny day and a lovely long ride following the coves and wooded points with scads of bayberries, thick green mosses, and here and there the delightfully pungent smell of cute friendly little skunk, which I love, much to the rollicking laughter of my best beau, who says I'm the first to say such a thing. You're so goddamn different, there's no wonder I love you, says he. I say amen, with reservations chalked up against our next sea-going battle. Rio is a long trip. Friday, September 22nd. The wind went out to the eastward, and there's rain, of course, right in from the Gulf Stream. finally induced Mother Bee to venture a ride in the Regal, drove through mud and small ponds in the road to Martinsville to see her sister Sophronia, Aunt 'Phrony, who wanted to go as a nurse to the Civil War, but was caught young by Captain McIntyre, one of the many boys Fred's grandfather, Captain John Hupper, rescued from the British Navy and brought home to Maine to man the Hupper fleet of sailing vessels, visited Uncle Joel and Aunt Mary, whose daughter Marjorie is finishing up at Hebron in preparation for Mount Holyoke, stopped on the way back to Herring Gut. I love that name. It fits so much better than austere Port Clyde, which is dour Scottish and not Elizabethan, as is the majority of the raucous, smiling village. At Mrs. Moody's, whom I persuaded to make a jacket for me. From the top of the hill above the Bolano estate of many tenements for the clam and sardine factory workers, one sees the noble windmill Captain J.W. installed to supply the typhoid-ridden village with pure water, and, far off, ranging from Mosquito Island to Monhegan, there are hundreds of sails at any time of day, 2- and 3-mast lime coasters, and wood-carrying schooners and pinkies, all beholden to the extensive lime-rock business of Thomaston, Rockland, and Rockport. Then there are scores of busy vessels plying to Long Cove for granite paving blocks to convert the waterfront roads of Boston, New York, and Philadelphia from mud to decent footing for the dray horses of those cities. Below the hill and beyond the Baptist Chapel, Conservative Brown, of course, and the Advent Church, nestled in the loft of George Brown's store, one sees the fishing fleet of white and sleekly lovely sloops off the cold storage, to which Gloucester and Lunenburg salt bankers come daily for mackerel bait and enormous cakes of ice, which boys push across the fish cove on high ramps for 10 cents an hour. Above the fish wharf, where 2- and 3-mast schooners lie a-building, stands Fred's ancestral home on a high point overlooking the entrance to the harbor, and, beyond, historical Monhegan, the cradle of New England, where Breton and Cornish fishermen were said to have salted their cod and dried their nets at least 3 centuries before Columbus was born. Hupper's Island helps form the entrance to the Heavenly Gut, and that is where Captain John Hupper, Fred's grandfather, settled, owning the whole island, Indian gardens, trees, and rich shores, and from there sending forth scores of vessels, captained by his sons and sons-in-law, to the West Indies, South America, Africa, and Europe, for gold and glory. What a glorious place is my new home! How distant the hot and cold gopher-ridden prairies of my father's homestead, where the only asset is loneliness called freedom. Go east, young gal. Saturday, September 23rd, 1911. An evening of pastel oranges and pinks, such as I saw today inside a seashell. Went this morning to Thomaston by auto, and took the trolley to Rockland, bouncing merrily. Such a dinner at the hospitable Thorndike Hotel, and then mouthed and rolled around on the tongue delicious pistachio ices at Mrs. Thurlow's parlor. Fuller, Cobb, and Davis have a department store better than the best in Boston. Fred introduced me to rare dishes. Cod tongues and sounds and cheeks are delicacies indeed, and the Finn and Hattie was swimming yesterday before smoked under a hogshead and over alder fire and smoke. Such a wealth these coastal people have, and yet cry poverty all day. Is their penuriousness but a constant reminder to save their many blessings? One can't starve here if he can amble to the shore, as the Indians knew when they'd come to the coast each spring from up the Penobscot to feast on lobsters and cunners and clams, all caught by merely wading into the eelgrass. Cousin Frank Trussell, who owns nearly as much of the village as Captain J.W., including the wharf, part of the cold store, the general store, the post office, and shares in God knows how many Bolano and Hupper and Fish vessels, collects 25 cents for cashing the check of a poor cannery worker, eats crackers and milk for supper, and won't have an auto because he says he needs the horse manure for his gardens. It is reported that when Captain J.W. came home from the Margaret Thomas for his annual blueberry spree, Frank looked mournfully at the bunch of bananas hanging in his store, and allowed as how he loved bananas, but couldn't eat them because they were too dear. Captain J.W. bought him the bunch. The next Sunday, Frank, deacon of the Baptist chapel, where 7 of the 12 stained windows tell of men lost at sea, one of them John Bolano, prayed for the lax and spendthrift soul of Captain J.W. Forgot to note that when the auto left the new state road below Thomaston, we got stuck in the mud near Gilcrest Hill, and were rescued by a team of white horses pulling us to terra firma. Called on Grandmother Sarah Wall Bolano, who asked again, "Be you from here or be you from away?" Went motoring without veil or coat in this lovely Indian summer weather, and saw the fog creep in from the Gulf Stream, where it meets the Labrador Current just offshore a bit. Such a busy, lovely day in this quaint and sparkling village, which is much more charming than any inland town. And the lingo, the accents, orts for garbage, direct from Saxon. "Get ye biaft," said Grandma Sarah to her son, thus telling him to stay behind her. "Bindina" sounds Asiatic, but really means, "Have you been to dinner?" "Get your chot, come to the flot, and bud the blot," is, of course, "Get your coat, come to the float, and board the boat." What else could it be? Best of all, the nicknames, Dump Monahan, Spider Simmons, Crow Morris, all descriptive of the bearers. Dump is short and squat. Spider plays ball as though he had 8 arms. Crow screams when talking, even whispering. "My guts is rising and falling with the tide," means the eating of too many clams. Deaf as a haddock, the dogfish come with the summer complaints. "I almost doubt it." Those are some of the descriptive gems heard daily. Sunday, September 24th, 1911. Went to church on the ridge, where all the tribe is buried in the yard, even though many of their bodies are still at sea. One monument marks a Bolano with the engraved message that his remains are on Tybee Island off Savannah. Another states that a Hupper was lost at sea. I'd like to add the statement, "Never found after he foundered." No wonder English is hard to teach. Meeting at the Port Clyde Baptist Church. Frank Trussell led the confessions of low sin after having done nothing more evil all week than tell his wife to hark. Had milk and pilot bread for supper because it's sinful to gorge on the Sabbath, meaning that good Calvinists should be sparing. Did you know, my daughter, before you looked it up, that the word spare comes from the Saxon spar, to save? It pays to serve Jesus. Monday, September 25th, 1911. Hemmed my suit skirt in the dense fog and mended my red gown. My boy is out, renewing old acquaintances and telling them lies, no doubt, of the big world about which they care nothing. Most of them have seen it anyway, but few of them know where they were, beyond remembering the docks and the waterfront gin mills. Cousin Watson, the family no good, went to sea with his older brother, Captain J.W., until set ashore off the entrance to Chesapeake Bay in the pilot boat for having insulted Mother B. Has been to Rio, pronounced Rio, to Cuba, spoken of QB, and I couldn't make him understand that he had been to Cienfuegos until I spelt it, and he said, "Oh, course, Cienfuegos." He might as well have stayed back home with his lobster pots. Mother B. is bright and smart and jolly. She was the favorite of her father's 10 children, the tomboy who would help him launch vessels, and she can still row a boat so well that she made Fred give her the oars to the dory yesterday when he was setting her on the island to visit her brother Oren. Still, she wouldn't eat the famous strawberries in Rio in December because, at home, they were out of season. And she still can't understand why sailing south from the equator isn't easier than sailing the other way, because it's downhill all the way. I do believe, though, that she's joshing me, and I'd better be a bit less proud of my brilliance in the company of these people who like to act ignorant when they really are quite adept in their own way at things that matter to them. Drove up the old road through Turkey to Glenmere in the enchanting autumn woods, and in came the river at several delightful coves. Tuesday, September 26th. Rained all night, and that settled the fog, but the roads are quagmires, so baked a cake to go with the jar of pear pickles given us by Captain Stanton's wife en route to being fitted at Dallas Moody's for my new jacket and lovely mauve belt, which shows that my shipboard fare has added an inch or two to my buxom belly. As we're probably bound for Rio, I shan't worry about my girth. The Latins love plump women. If Fred wants a sylph, I'll tell him that only Parisians like slender girls, and that I'll gladly starve if he'll get us a charter to France. Wednesday, September 27th, 1911. Union Fair, and the trick the man done. Hundreds of sunburned mouths from all the gaping. 54 miles in the machine, and only 2 flat tires. Wonderful Camden Hills in the distance, the hills which marked fishing grounds for the Europeans since the Icelanders sailed and rowed along the coast 900 years ago and told no one, especially not the Pope, since all good fishermen don't want their best spots visited by anyone. And the Pope was Spanish, too, and wanted his people to catch the bacalao. Can you blame Henry VIII for telling him to cut bait? Stopped at the Washburn Mansion in dear old Thomaston. They've built the family's vessels at Port Clyde and Thomaston for years. Started as sailmakers for the big square riggers built for the Baring Brothers Bank of London back when Yankee ships sailed the British under, and the smart bankers knew where to go for the best. The road lined with trees loaded with luscious red apples and green firs above the gem of a winding river. But to get information about these things that interest my prying mind is enough to make me nearly burst with frustration. These down-easters act so stolidly when asked for names and explanations, but oh, how they exude over an anecdote belittling someone, or over a meal of clam chowder, lobster, blueberry pie with ice cream. And the descriptions. That alewife was well-timbered. Friday, September 29th, 1911. 2 days of visiting. The Watermans at Ash Point from California, where they made a fortune after being carried there free by Captain John Hupper around the Horn to get rid of them, Fred says. Fred sailed the car to call on them and on the Skinners and Captain Joel Hupper. With all his land roving, I am getting sea fever. So after the lobster dinner coming up, I'll start hemming my Rio dress. I shall also read up on Brazil and find some Cape Cod Bravo to mimic for the Portuguese accent, which is much softer than Spanish. With all that done, the trip to Rio will materialize, or else I shall throw to Neptune not only my old shoes, but also that old pink gown I've been wearing for years, just because it hasn't the grace to quit and get tattered. Neptune can use it for one of his mermaids, the old philanderer. Tuesday, October 31st, Boston. Sailing tomorrow for Rio. I've had such a sea fever since my last entry weeks ago that I just couldn't burden you, my poor diary, with such stuff as who baked what apple pie. Maine was exquisitely beautiful and the people so warm and kind, but it's not Rio de Janeiro. It's more jolly to have Fred tacking the ship instead of the auto. Rain doesn't seem strange at sea as it does on land. Food tastes better. Even the lobsters we brought with us on board. Goodbye to great Aunt Katie Seavey, who, having been a sea widow for 57 years, will hardly miss us. Farewell to Aunt Phrony and her misbegotten Civil War, as well as to Grandmother Sarah, who still doesn't know whether I'm from here or from away. Adios to Mother B, who showed me the island where she roved and ranged along the shore, picking lobsters out of the eelgrass, Indian trinkets from the old Indian garden, and spent her girlhood as a better sailor and fisher than her sea-going brothers, and came ashore as soon, no sooner, as she was betrothed to Captain J.W., who was smart enough to marry the owner's daughter. Au revoir to the Pinkhams and to Mary Davis, who jumped from the frying pan of teaching in Puerto Rico to marrying a lobster fisherman at Port Clyde, a situation not to be described so much as a leap into a fire as into a cold douche. Auf Wiedersehen to naughty cousin Pierce and his proclivities for raunchy stories and raunchier women, whose nastier aspects he held up before Fred to try undermining the holy knot which no man should rip asunder, damn him. Short shrift to the damnable auto, which caught fire one morning and had a collision the same afternoon. Even an impatient shrug to the Columbus Day procession, and I used to love parades. Miles of Italians marching past the governor's pavilion, and 16 other lands represented with gaudy banners and silly streamers, as I clung with boredom to an iron fence and longed for the open sea and its perfume of good salt, some of which the marchers should have used for a bath. That's all we have time for in this edition of the Maine Reader. We're reading The Log of the Skipper's Wife, The Diary of Dorothea Moulton Bellano, edited by her son James. I'm Cynthia Bowman. Thank you for listening.